words of Naomi Wolf, motherhood is one of the most challenging and creative jobs anyone can do. But why then are mothers so often diminished or discriminated against in our culture? Why is the work of bearing and raising children often thought of as unimportant? And why are issues relating to motherhood and parenting so low on the political agenda? These are some of the questions that Maddie McMahon explores in her outstanding book, Why Mothering Matters. And on today's episode, we have the honour of speaking to Maddie about the art of mothering and why it does really matter. My name is Caroline Johansson, and you're listening to the podcast To Become a Mother. So, Maddie, you are a birth and postnatal doula, doula course leader, and doula mentor. You're also a breastfeeding counselor, mother of two children, and stepmom of one, and the author of two books, Why Doulas Matter and Why Mothering Matters. So, welcome, Maddie. It's really great to have you here on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to be here.
You know, you are a woman of many accomplishments, but today we're speaking about your book, Why Mothering Matters. And really, it's a beautiful account of what it means to become a mom, and also, I guess, a call for a bit more recognition of the work that mothers are doing on a daily basis. And when I read your book, it really resonated with me, because when I became a mom, I just went through such a transformational shift. And I was thinking, God, why did no one tell me? How can this happen to so many women? And there is so little discussion about it. And you mention in your book, you talk about the transformational shift that we go through as mothers. And you say it's emotional, it's physical, and it's hormonal. I was hoping that you could explain that a little bit more. What is it that happens to us when we have children?
That's a really good question. And it's a really enormous question. And and it's related very much to the other rites of passage that women go through. You were saying that, you know, you didn't know and nobody taught you anything. We weren't taught about how our bodies work during puberty either, were we? And we're not taught about what will happen to our bodies when we go through menopause. So pregnancy and the postpartum is another rite of passage, another enormous thing, transformation that to our bodies that is veiled. And it, you know, is hidden and is somehow seen as something not quite nice that shouldn't be spoken about in polite company. Especially, I think, because these things are about parts of the female body that are seen as taboo. We might get told after we have a baby that our uterus is going to take some time to shrink back to its previous size. We might not get told that those contractions might hurt, especially if we've had a baby before. We probably know that we're going to make milk after the baby's born, even if we don't intend to use that milk, but we probably won't get told anything much about that, about what's technically called lactogenesis to the milk coming in and the engorgement that that can cause. We're probably not told that during pregnancy, our blood volume has increased massively and that we're going to have to get rid of all of that extra fluid from pregnancy and that we might have night sweat. We're definitely not told very much about lochia, the bleeding after childbirth.
Yeah.
How long that might last, what we should expect in terms of how heavy it should be and what it should look like and when to be worried. All of this stuff we have to learn on the hoof, in the moment, as we're going through it, at a time when our brains also have the cognitive builders in. You talked about physical changes, but also cognitive changes are going on. We're going through a massive learning curve. Our brains are making new brain cells, new grey matter that is creating new neural pathways for all of the new tasks
Wow. So your brain is actually growing in that.
That's right. So, you know, we talk about baby brain and like, you know, it's a negative. It's almost insulting that when you get pregnant, when you've had a baby, somehow your brain is not going to be working as efficiently. And colleagues at work might, you know, they might ridicule you because you're not as effective with your brain anymore. But actually what's happening is there's, I always like to think of it, it's like it's more than just having new wallpaper. You have got the builders in and they're knocking down walls and doing a complete revamp of your house totally. And so during that time, obviously everything feels a bit discombobulating. You might not feel like you're functioning on your A game. But once that whole process is done, your house is beautiful and it's going to work for you much more effectively and efficiently.
How long time does that process take?
You know what? I don't know. But certainly a lot of mothers talk about feeling like they come out of the fog at some point. And typically on all sorts of level, a turning point seems to be when the child is about 3.
Oh, that's quite late, yeah.
We are possibly, hopefully, getting a little bit more sleep by then.
Mm-hmm.
We've come out of the chrysalis. We've grown our mothering wings. We're feeling a bit more competent. Brain function has improved. We've got a rhythm. We've found our new normal.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we're beginning to take those first steps into really feeling into what our new identity is as mother, as parent, as no longer the baby of the family. And that's a whole new way of looking at yourself and looking at the world. And that, you know, that of course that's going to take a while. This is not something that happens in a few days or a few weeks.
No, but at the same time, it seems to happen also very quickly. In a very short space of time, you have, it's almost like as soon as the baby is born, or even when you're pregnant, like that's actually a very short space of time that you suddenly feel so different and view the world already then so differently.
Exactly. And that isn't Mother Nature wonderful? That she gives us these incredible hormones that help us get pregnant in the first place, help get the baby out, and then create a safe place for that baby. And almost immediately the baby is born.
Mm.
We're having these massive peaks of oxytocin. And oxytocin is such an interesting hormone. It's famous for it being the hormone of love. That's what everyone goes on about. This is the hormone of calm and connection. It bonds us with our partners so that we can conceive the baby. It bonds us with our baby once the baby is born. It helps milk flow. But also what oxytocin does is make us incredibly vigilant. So we're totally like, what's that over there? Is that a tiger creeping up on me and my baby? So high levels of oxytocin can actually make us feel quite anxious. So a lot of mothers in the early days will talk about feeling quite anxious, checking the baby all the time. We all remember that, prodding the baby. Are you still breathing?
Yeah.
or kind of wanting to grab the baby back from Auntie Doris who smells of perfume and feeling really angry and anxious about things that other people don't appear to be bothered by. So that's stepping us into that mothering role really quickly, fueled by those chemicals.
And it also explains why, particularly those first few weeks, you can go from incredibly highs to the lowest lows very quickly and without really knowing. And I guess it's because there's so much oxytocin, maybe you react anxiously and very happily at the same time.
Absolutely. It's a time of complete contradictions, really. And obviously, as well as the oxytocin, your estrogen and progesterone hormones from pregnancy are dropping exponentially in those first few days. So that can be a real oh, as you hit rock bottom. And then obviously then your milk comes in, and that can be a really emotional day. But with that comes prolactin, and prolactin is the mothering hormone. It's the one that, whilst, you know, it's famous for being the maker of milk, prolactin. It's also the hormone that makes us feel really zen, really, and really sleepy. It's a soporific hormone. So that helps us go back down into sleep really easily, in the middle of the night when we've fed our babies. And that's really protective, obviously, because sleep deprivation is one of the killers of mental health.
Yeah, and something that I think, even though we have that hormone, with the lack of sleep, that can be quite difficult if you don't have enough support and people helping you in those early days. So you wrote this book about why mothering matters. But my question is, why did you feel that that book was necessary in today's world?
It was born out of frustration and anger, really. I think when I started thinking about writing that book, I'd been a doula for about 15 years and a breastfeeding counsellor for about 13 or 14 years. And it's just really boring and really frustrating to listen to the same stories over and over again of my clients losing jobs or losing out on their promotions or being swept sideways at work while they're on maternity leave, or having to grapple with hard choices that men don't have to choose when they become parents. Do I stay at home? Do I carry on working? And just having that choice is a privilege. For some of my clients, actually, when they did their sums, the childcare, there was absolutely no financial point staying at work. So if they were going to stay in that career, in that job, then it would be doing it for free for 3 years until they could get some state-funded childcare, just to stay on the same place on the ladder at work. And that just has always struck me as incredibly unfair. Mm-hmm. I have probably an overinflated sense of justice. It's got me in trouble a lot in my life. So I just wanted to shout about it, really. Motherhood is something that hasn't actually been politicized.
Mm.
It's overlooked a lot by politicians. It's overlooked a lot by, you know, social movements like feminism. Massive feminism, feminist, been a feminist since the 80s when I was at university, and discovered, you know, fledgling intersectional feminism that was really just starting to come into the philosophy of a female emancipation at that time. But as soon as I became a mother, I realized that actually everything that feminism was saying about the personal being the political didn't seem to apply to what was going on for me right now, having babies. The feminism that I grew up with was all about not having those kids hanging on your apron strings.
Yeah.
Being as good as the men, having all of the same opportunities as men, and denying our biology. Let's just push it aside and pretend it's not there. And actually, I think that was absolutely playing into the patriarchal paradigm. Got us to go to work and benefit the economy, which benefits patriarchy.
And there's also this narrative in our society, at least in the circles where I hang out, that talking about things relating to motherhood or raising babies are seen as quite trivial. And, you know, your career, those are like the hard things, the things to focus on. And I completely agree with you that that's denying a huge part of the female existence, to not accredit that any weight in the world society.
Absolutely. And I think we're pushed all the time into binary
discussions about female life choices. People will often ask me, I read your book, Maddie, so what do you think? Should women stay at home with their children in the early days, or should they go to work? And I just say, oh gosh, I probably need to write the book again then, if you haven't got the message that the only thing I believe is that you should have true freedom of choice, mm-hmm. and that whatever you choose, society should be supporting you in that. Not just clap, clap, clap supporting you, but actually practically supporting you in a way that, you know, lots of other countries have subsidized childcare and financial help to stay at home with your children if that's what you want.
Yeah.
Lots of other countries realize that if you support mothers, then you support children in the early years. And if you support children in the early years, then you support your society, you support your economy, and everything. Everything flows from there. But in the UK, we've got it completely topsy-turvy. If anything is cut, it's early years provision. It appears to not matter. They think, oh, it doesn't have any effect. We've got to put, you know, lots of emphasis on schooling and university, or, you know, all of the other things. But 0 to 3 is always forgotten, and maternity is always forgotten.
Yeah, and we're recording this in the summer of 2020, and what I've noticed is that in the Conservative leadership contest, there's been very little conversations about childcare, which I think says a lot about the priorities and the values you assign to this. So no, I completely agree with you. And this also leads us into my other question. You say in the book that becoming a mother in today's world feels more complicated and painful than ever. Are you able to elaborate on that a little bit more?
There's so much going on, isn't there? On one level, when I think about my grandmother's and my great-grandmother's generation, I feel lucky that I have the freedom and the choices that they didn't have. But they also had social mores that were very strict. They had a moral and ethical framework that went with being part of a religious community. And so they knew what was going to happen to them. They knew that at every turning point in their life, there would be a ritual or a ceremony to ease them through that passage.
Mm.
They knew what would happen to them when they had a baby. No, not the actual physical, you know, my grandma had no idea how babies came out of bodies until it happened to her. But she knew what would happen in terms of her mother would come, everybody in the street would bring food, everyone would help. She knew that she could rely on that community support. She knew how old her baby would be when she went back to church for the first Sunday after staying at home, after the baby was born. She knew what would happen when she died. She knew where she was going to be buried. Everything was mapped out. And whilst our generation reacts quite vociferously against that kind of mapped out life course, what it provides is certainty and social support. Everyone knew in those days that you could expect that social support when you had a baby, and it was expected for you to pay it forward.
Mm.
These days, we have freedom and choices, and with that comes life wobbles. What do I do? How do I do this for the best? And how do I do this when I've no longer got that community? So many of us live just in a nuclear family. We have our partner, and that's it. We move around for jobs, maybe. Mm. So so many of us live in places where we didn't grow up.
Mm.
We don't have those roots. We don't have Auntie Doris living next door anymore. And we don't have the family relationships of trust that we used to have. Often say that it's really easy to look back in history and say, oh, you know, it was a golden age. There were probably all sorts of the same problems. as there are now that I see in my clients in terms of, you know, relationships with family and how those play out around the time that a baby is being born. But I do think that we have lost a lot along the way. That isolation we know is a risk factor for postnatal depression.
Whilst we have probably moved further away from our family physically, nowadays there is social media, the internet. What do you think about that as a substitution for having family close by?
I don't think social media is any different to any other aspect of life. If I went into a town square with my newborn baby and shouted to everybody, I'm feeling a bit overwhelmed. I don't know what to do for the best right now. Can anyone help me? You would get a combination of people ignoring you, people telling you you should know better, or this is what I did, so it's probably the best thing. And the odd person coming up and saying, how are you feeling? Would you like to sit down? Can I get you a drink? Tell me more about it. Social media is exactly the same. It is, it can be a minefield, but it can be absolutely amazing. So what I try to do with clients is help them develop the skills of assessing who's helping you, because yeah, not all advice is created equal, is it?
No, I do need to assess them before you take them sometimes. But you do talk in your book too about the importance of being well supported as a mom. How do you think? Do you think we support mothers well in today's society? And I guess this is quite connected to what we just spoken about.
No, we don't do it. On all kinds of levels, we don't. And actually, I need to go back and add another chapter to that book, because it's worse. It's much worse since I wrote it. Maternity services are falling apart. And so mothers are starting out on the journey more likely to be traumatized, more likely not to have been loved through the process. They might have been kept clinically safe. You know, they've come out alive. But that appears to be the pinnacle of our aspirations for parents and babies right now, is put them through this conveyor belt and churn them out the other side alive, tick. But that, you know, that's the bare minimum we should be expecting for our new parents and the smallest, most vulnerable members of our society. So no, they're not getting good maternity care. In many cases, they're not getting any postnatal care whatsoever. And if they are getting any, they have to get off their sofas and get to the hospital in order to be checked. And that's bad enough if you're a privileged middle class family who can get in your car. But imagine if you have to get on a bus, still bleeding, maybe having had a major surgery 4 or 5 days beforehand with your brand new baby. It's just not acceptable. And then, you know, as I was saying before, it doesn't get any better. We walk around in a society that damns us if we do and damns us if we don't, whatever choice we make. Bottle feed, you feel like people are judging you. Breastfeed, people tell you to put your tits away. Stay at home, oh, you're just a stay-at-home mum, oh, dear me. Go to work, oh, don't you miss your children? Don't you think your children would be better off if you stayed with them in the early years? Don't you worry about them, you know, not getting the benefit of your mothering if you send them to preschool? It's just never ending, isn't it?
And with the breast and bottle feeding, you also mentioned that when women are pregnant, there's a lot of messages thrown at them about the importance of breastfeeding and that they should breastfeed. But then it's suddenly like they give birth, there is an issue, and then there's a U-turn. It's like, well, just get the formula. And I was wondering why you think that is, if it's only a question of lack of resources to have the support available to women to help them breastfeed if that's what they want to do. Mm-hmm. Or is it, you know, a cultural issue, you know, something deeper, something else?
It's everything. I think the politics of infant feeding is one of the most complex subjects and really hard to even touch the surface of in a short podcast like this. But we have some social attitudes that have become embedded in the last few generations since formula was invented, since women started routinely working outside the home. Formula has been sold to us as a scientific advance on nature, a way of not being tied to our children and being free to make the life choices that we want to make for ourselves and pursue our careers just like the men. And I get it. I get that. Absolutely, I do. But unfortunately, we haven't been able to invent something that is a scientific advance on nature. So whilst most children will be absolutely fine on formula, there are overpopulations risks to formula feeding. So we have these social attitudes. We have attitudes about breasts in many Western European countries that is very different to the rest of the world in terms of them being seen as sexual organs. Whereas in many countries, they're not at all. They're just seen as things you feed babies with. So the whole thing about getting them out in public has people tied up in knots.
It's very intimidating.
Yeah, it can be. It can be at first, especially when you know that there are people out there who can be quite angry when you do it. There's a whole history there. There's a whole kind of unpicking of long held social attitudes. And then all of that history and all of those social attitudes are jumped on by very, very clever madmen in the, you know, in the marketing arena. You know, when I talk about madmen, I'm talking about the TV program. You know, they're thinking really cleverly, how can we market this product? How can we embed these presumptions and social attitudes in people? For example, the idea that fathers need to bond with their babies.
I was just thinking about
by
that.
Giving them a bottle.
Yeah.
Actually came from an advert for formula milk in the 1950s in America. Before that, that hadn't occurred to us because, well, before we invented bottles and formula, dads definitely loved their kids.
Yeah. I've heard stories about women just pumping milk because it's so important to their husbands that they get to feed a baby too. And I was thinking that it's just ludicrous. What? Yeah. How time consuming isn't that? How complicated?
Absolutely.
And you're taking away the benefits of, you know, one of the main benefits is that it's quite easy just to give
exactly.
the breast to a baby.
Yeah. Exactly. So what a brilliant example of women being made to expend physical and emotional labor in order to provide something to a man because he thinks that that's his, he's entitled to that.
Yeah. But do you think there is enough, taking that aside, like, is there enough support for women?
No.
If they want to breastfeed?
Absolutely not. We, you know, as I say in the book, we put this kind of moral thing on them during pregnancy. I know that almost every health professional would say, oh, we don't lay any kind of pressure on them in pregnancy. We just provide them with facts. But what the women are walking away with is, oh, it's better. It's better to breastfeed. I should do that. Everybody expects me to. If I don't, I'm a bad mother. People are going to judge me if I don't. That's the message that they're receiving. And so dutifully, when the baby's born, they try to breastfeed. And of course, layered on top of that is a biological urge. So there's all of this stuff going on that they're not really aware of, not conscious of, because it's encoded in our DNA to put the baby to the breast or want to. So all of that's going on. But simultaneously, there's actual sabotage. There's ignorance, bad advice, lack of time, lack of skill in the people who are caring for them. And so the rug's pulled out from under their feet. And what really makes me furious is that I talk to mothers and birthing people all the time who then are bearing the guilt for that. They feel that they failed. They feel that they were responsible for their baby not getting their milk. And that breaks my heart because they were failed. They were absolutely sabotaged.
Yeah, I completely agree. Another question that I had for you is about the society we live in now where it's so easy to read things on the internet. There's a lot of information available when you become a mom. A lot of advice is given everywhere. And in one way, that is, you know, a huge benefit to living in the age that we live, that this is readily available. But it also leads to, I suspect, a lot of confusion sometimes when the advice is contradictory. What is your take on this society that we live in now where advice is so prevalent and readily available?
I think on one level it's absolutely wonderful. And I see the beginnings of a revolution. I see the beginnings of women and parents in general just stepping into their own power. They're realizing that they're getting less and less support from the state and that they can't just relax into the beautiful arms of the NHS to, you know, to love and nurture them through the process. That's not there. So they've got to stand on their own two feet and do their research and think about what they want and how they're going to get it. And there's some amazing stuff going on out there with parents coming together and supporting each other and people, midwives, doulas, breastfeeding counsellors, providing them with the information and the choices that they need to really own their own journey and become the parents that they feel happy and comfortable with. But I also see a lot of confusion. I see a lot of people asking a question on social media and then a long thread, as you say, of completely conflicting. Well, I did this and I did that. So I think as social media goes forward, ordinary people are going to have to learn some skills. The skills of being able to communicate in a way that helps people make their own choices. So rather than saying, I did this, this is what you should do, it can be so much more useful to say, well, some people do it like this and some people like to do it like that. Both of those have some pros and cons. And both of those, neither of those might suit you, your personality, your lifestyle, your family circumstances. Maybe you could go and read this because it's going to give you some facts and some evidence and some the scientific basis for your choices. Whatever you choose is going to be right for you. That's the ethos that doulas have. That's how we support people. In fact, the word advice is kind of pretty taboo in the doula world because it implies telling people what to do. So maybe if we're all going to get on well in social media without there being big rows and pylons and people being upset and stomping off, we could all just maybe learn a few teeny tiny little skills of communication that are supportive rather than dictatorial.
Yeah. It also applies, I think, to parenting books, because when I read them, I was very confused. You know, there was the attachment theory books where basically I wasn't allowed to put my baby down. And then it was the hardcore sleep training books. And both of them, you know, whatever camp you were reading, they were certain that they were right. And they felt like there was quite a lot of value attached to it from their perspective. You know, this was the right way and it's the only way. So yeah, those parenting books would leave me totally confused.
Yeah, I hear you. I absolutely hear you. And it's something that really grates on a lot of us working in this world, the way that some of those books, many of those books, are written, and how a lot of those books are written by people who have absolutely no credentials. I'm a celebrity who's had a baby, so I'm just going to write a book and tell you how to do it my way, which is valueless, absolutely valueless. Parents need to be able to find their way. So actually, we need books and we need people out there encouraging parents to take the eclectic way. Like, this is, these are some way, these are some parenting ethoses. These work for some people, this works for other people. Let's try some things. Let's experiment. And not only look and see how our kids get on with that, but how does it feel in our tummies? You know, if we do something and actually you get that funny feeling in your tummy and it feels wrong, don't do it.
I think that's really good advice, because if you can trust your own instinct or lean into that a little bit more, you probably end up being less worried of doing something wrong. Because if you're just pinning everything on what you've read and the advice you have, it's, you know, you feel like you're following this map. And if you step away from that, it's catastrophic and it's all wrong.
Absolutely. You are the pinnacle of millions of years of evolution. You know how to do this. It's encoded in your DNA. And the problem comes when somebody comes along and tells you to do something that's against your instinct.
Mm. You talk in the book about women, for economic reasons primarily, they decide to have children later and later in life. And obviously there are some fertility issues associated with that. The longer you wait, the more of a risk there might be, and it could be more difficult to conceive. But you also mentioned some other things that can be problematic when you wait until you get older to have children. Are you able to talk a bit about what those are?
I think there can be some negative social attitudes. So it always makes me laugh, really. There's a really narrow window in British culture where we're allowed to have babies. If you're too young, then, you know, you're a tart who's got up the duff, and you're probably a single mum who's like just got pregnant to get a council house. And then if you're old, then you're going to be a drain on society, and you know, you're not going to be able to have a baby, and you're going to have IVF, and that's going to cost the NHS loads of money, and then you'll be dead before your kid goes to university. So there is this, like, what, 3 years in the middle where we're actually allowed to have babies?
Yeah.
So there's all of those social attitudes that my clients who are over 40 have probably had to contend with when they get pregnant. And then, you know, they've had a long time to be who they are. So, you know, obviously, you know, we talked earlier about how that whole identity shift that happens when we become parents. Well, obviously, if you've been in this identity for a long time and then a baby comes along, that shift is, you know, that it can be a shock. We talk about baby shock. And it is a thing, and it's much more likely. It's something that I notice much more in my older clients, just reassessing who they are and their whole life when this baby comes along. And then, you know, they have to contend with feeling like, being made to feel like they have fewer choices when it comes to how they have the baby, with, you know, being called elderly, with this dusty old womb that's going to fall apart and not be able to push a baby out. So why don't we just schedule you for an elective cesarean, love? And that can be really disappointing for women who had dreamed of giving birth in other ways. And it's hard to tease out the facts from maybe just the entrenched preconceptions and attitudes of obstetricians, because it seems to me that if we are intervening in older women's pregnancies more, then how do we know what they're capable of? And when we intervene more, we often create the very risk that the doctors say they were worried about in the first place. If we worry that women's old wombs will bleed more, then why are we inducing them and putting stress on those uteruses? Or why are we cutting into those uteruses? It doesn't make any sense to me. So there's a lot of pressure that they're under. And yes, you know, maybe if you were a little bit older, you're more likely to perhaps have gestational diabetes or already be diabetic or to have other health concerns. But I can tell you that if you talk to any doula, they will tell you stories of mums who've been told all of this doom and gloom about being over 40, who've had beautiful, ecstatic births at home or in midwife-led units without any need for medical intervention, if that's what they wanted. So I think the default is let's trust our bodies. Let's see what they're capable of. And we're really lucky that we've got the medical professional there if we need them.
Thank you so much. It's been a lovely, lovely conversation. It's so refreshing to hear your perspective on what it means to be a mother. So thank you.
You're so welcome. It's been fun.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.